The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
I'm so glad you've joined us today on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to save more and spend less. And don't let anyone ever rip you off. We're going to talk about a big ripoff that's booming right now in the United States in just seconds. Our web address, Clark.com. You have a question for me, Clark.com/ask. And today, instead of a Clark Rageous moment, coming up in 20 minutes, a continuation of yesterday's sizzling deals on cell phone plans. Rates have been cut yet again since yesterday. I'll tell you what's weird. If you haven't shopped your cell phone plan in the last 15 days, odds are you're paying too much. I don't think I've ever said a cycle that short, but it's a story moving that quickly. Details coming up in 20 minutes. And later this hour, if you know someone in your family or you or a work colleague is traveling outside the United States, there's something you need to know about your return to the United States and rights you have and rights you don't have when you come back in, back to our country. Even if you're a citizen, there's stuff you need to know. I want to talk right now about a fast growing crime in the United States. Apparently, hackers, criminal rings have broken the code on how to steal money from ATMs. Criminals are duplicating people's accounts, or duplicating their cards, or in the case of apparently a widespread number of attacks on Chase Bank, who is using these new cardless ATMs in a number of cities around the country, criminals have figured out how to hack into your account, use the bank app against it at its own ATMs, and have money spit out by the thousands. The Cleveland Plain Dealer has done the best reporting on this problem around the country. Banks are all trying to, and this is the big pivot year, to end the use of ATM cards, because the technology on the ATM cards goes back, it's over 50 years old. And the technology is so insecure that apparently a middle schooler, maybe even an elementary school kid, if they're sharp, can crack the code on the ATM cards and can steal money willy-nilly. So the banks are rushing to new systems that will work either by biometrics or with the app on your smartphone. The problem is, has been clear with the deployment of this by Chase, is that criminals have already figured out how to hack the new smartphone apps for withdrawing from ATMs. And the worst part, as far as Chase is concerned, and you need to be aware of this if you're a customer of Chase, is instead of being there for their customers when their accounts have been hacked, Chase has been, if anything, a hostile partner with their customers and refusing to reimburse customers unless you're really persistent, or a newspaper reporter calls, to get your own money restored to your account. Here's what you need to know. The ATM system is so woefully insecure and not secured at all that you should consider doing what more and more people are doing. And that is, if you need to get cash as you're out and about, you have a separate account that you have tied into withdrawing money from an ATM. And you only have in it what you need to be able to fund walking around money as you need to withdraw from an ATM. Because let me tell you, the banks are fighting from behind in this area. And if you have your ATM card tied into your main transaction account that you pay rent or pay mortgage or pay car loan, pay your bills, and your money gets emptied from your checking account, and you're then in that fight with your bank to get your own money restored, you first need to know that for consumer accounts, if your account is compromised, even because of your own carelessness, you are not liable and your bank must restore those funds that were looted from the ATM. But unfortunately, in this wave of crime that is escalating dramatically, according to police sources, you haven't done anything wrong. The criminals have exploited weaknesses at the bank. But if your bank is failing to do its job under the law and restore your funds, I want you to immediately file a complaint at consumerfinance.gov. And by the way, doing a complaint with your bank to try to get money restored after criminals hacked into your account does not mean calling on the phone or talking to someone in a branch. Under the way banking regulations work, a bank is only accountable if you dispute an item in writing. The banks have a form for that. You go into a branch, you fill out the form, and it starts a clock. And the bank only has so much time to either provisionally or permanently restore your money. But here's the big catch that the Cleveland Plain Dealer reported about in the case of Chase Bank. They would issue people a provisional credit and then come back later and say, we've concluded our investigation and took your money away. Took it back. You are not supposed to have to prove you're innocent. The bank has to prove that you stole the money and pretended you didn't. The reality is the fraud is so rampant and the banks have been asleep at the switch again. So no, the ATM network is vulnerable. And one thing I'd suggest to you is use technology to protect you from technology. You can have text alerts sent to you by most financial institutions, banks and credit unions, when there is activity on your ATM card. And so the second you get an alert of a text that money was withdrawn and you know you didn't withdraw that money, you immediately pounce on your bank and you say, that is not my withdrawal. I'm sitting here with my card in my hands. And by the way, if you want to send me on an all expense paid vacation to wherever the card was used, I'd like that because I've never been there. Give me my money back. Understand, banks look at you as an adversary, not a customer, when it comes to issues of fraud. You need to be assertive to make sure they don't squash you like a bug. And after the criminal is stolen from the bank then thinks it's okay to steal from you. Austin is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Austin.
Hey, Clark. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. You are an entrepreneur.
Yes, sir. That's right.
Good for you. How can I be of service to you as an entrepreneur?
Sure. So I listen to your show frequently, and one of the things I'm struggling with is I have a credit freeze. So I had to unfreeze my credit, and now I'm obviously exposed. So I'm wondering what I can do, maybe like Credit Karma or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, Credit Karma myself and Credit Sesame both. While your credit's thawed, it would be great to register at both of those. And, for example, with Credit Karma, you have free credit monitoring, and they'll be able to alert you if there's any new account activity taking place under your identity, completely free. Credit Sesame and Credit Karma both give you the ability to monitor how you're doing with your credit as you go about the process of trying to get financing for your business. You're able to see, hey, my score's blah, blah, blah. I'm in good shape to borrow that money. What are your funding needs for your business? Is it short term or is it long term? Do you need a huge amount of money, a moderate amount of money?
Just a moderate amount of money, and it's short term. But since I don't have any business credit history, they have to pull my personal credit.
Which they would do. Let me tell you, they do that anyway. You could be in your own business for 15 years, and they'll still pull your personal credit, and they will also pierce what's known as the corporate veil and almost always require you to sign a personal guarantee. So what I would recommend to you is don't borrow money as a business. Borrow money as an individual that you use for the business purposes. You'll still be able to deduct, you know, the interest as a business expense where you could not personally, but it's money that you're using for operating capital for your business. And the terms and conditions you're under, let's say as an example, you use a personal credit card to buy things for your business. You just pay the bill through the business and you recognize the expense and the interest, if you pay any interest on the cards, as business expenses. And that is a perfectly acceptable, legitimate business purpose for you to do.
So, Clark, that's good advice. What about, how long does it take to generate business credit history?
Well, okay, so when you refer to business credit history, people usually are referring to a D&B report done in Bradstreet, and that's based on trade lines, how you pay the bills you have. If somebody, you buy a product or service and they send you a bill net 10 or net 30, over time, you may end up with a D&B. And so that is the business equivalent of something like a credit score for a business. And so that's how people might decide, let's say you're buying from a supplier, and they're trying to decide if they should be willing to extend you net 10, net 15, net 30, whatever. And they may, in fact, go look at a D&B report. Those have become much less important, generally, than they used to be, because until you get real size to your business, people are generally expecting you to pay on delivery or pay at time of order.
And if you don't mind, can I ask you one more question?
Okay.
So I'm looking at phone services as well. Do you have any recommendations for VoIP services?
Yeah, Packet 8 is one that business owners are very happy with. I'm trying to think what their website is. I think they use, let me see, punching in right now, 8x8.com. In addition to that, that's strictly a business phone system that allows such flexibility, it's mind-blowing. There's also UMA for Business, which is a very popular business phone service now, OOMA. If you go to OOMA.com and then you go to their business service. And I think those two are the ones that are best known as far as having a VoIP-type business phone service.
Great. I appreciate your help.
Okay, and best of luck to you with your business.
Yep.
Normally at this time, you'd be hearing a Clarkrageous moment, but today, a continuation of yesterday's sizzling deal, an all-out slugfest for your business among the nation's cell phone carriers as we have vigorous competition going on among the big four. Yesterday, Verizon finally capitulated as the market share losses became too painful for them to be exposed, being so much more expensive than everybody else. Now, Verizon again offering unlimited data plans within minutes of Verizon's new rate cuts, T-Mobile cut rates again. T-Mobile has a new plan for couples that is unlimited data, high-def video, hotspot 10 gigs each per month, $100 per month total for two, including all junk fees and taxes. So, you know, normally you might pay, if you had a $100 bill, by the time all the junk fees and taxes are added in, you'd end up probably $117. So T-Mobile doesn't charge any of the junk fees and taxes anymore, so it's a flat $100 for two people. Plus, anybody else on T-Mobile will, as of Friday, have full high-def video, no more degrading of the quality of the video on the unlimited data plans, 10 gig hotspot per line on your plan, and Sprint continues to offer five lines with unlimited data, of course, talk and text, total of $90 a month plus junk fees for the five lines, $18 a month per line, now till March of next year. That is an incredible deal. The cell phone equation just gets better and better. The irony of ironies is that the monopoly companies that provide home internet, imposing hard data caps around the country with massive overage charges, the cell phone carriers now going to unlimited data, and you might consider, if it's just you at your home or a couple of people, a couple whatever, going to getting all your data off your cell phone and disconnecting your home traditional internet plan.
You know, when you're a kid, there are a lot of things that you think exist. Unicorns, dragons, mermaids, you name it. When you're a kid, it's real. But when you find out later that they don't, well, it's kind of disappointing. Of course, as you get older, you get over the disappointment. But when you're looking to buy a car, there's nothing worse than finding the one of your dreams online, and then you find out later it doesn't really exist. It's not true. That's why at TrueCar, they show you real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing offered to you by TrueCar. It's an actual VIN-based price from a TrueCar-certified dealer in your area. Real prices. And these aren't just any dealers either. TrueCar-certified dealers are a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency. They offer competitive prices and a faster, easier buying experience for you. It's a fact. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with the TrueCar certified dealers. And, on average, they save over $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that dream car, visit TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
It's great to have you here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to keep more of what you make. On the web, Clark.com. When you have a question for me, Clark.com/ask. There's something that you may not be aware of. As an American citizen, if you leave the country, you know, you go to the Bahamas, you go to Mexico, you go to Canada, the three most common places I think Americans go. You go further overseas. You go to Europe, Asia, South America, wherever. When you come back to the United States and you get to immigration and customs, you do not have the same rights, the same due process as you do as an American citizen once you were considered to be officially on American soil. There's a story that's created a huge uproar on the web and on social media about a NASA engineer who's born in the Los Angeles metro area. And when Sid came back to the United States and was at immigration, he was taken to an interrogation room. He was first taken to an empty holding cell, and after, with no explanation, and after a wait of, by his telling, 40 minutes, he was taken to an interrogation room, and he was told that he needed to turn over his cell phone, and give the password to his phone or code to unlock his phone. And he at first refused because he works for NASA. There's all kinds of highly classified information that is password protected on his phone. The Immigration Service personnel didn't want to hear anything about it. They said, you either turn it over or else. And he didn't know what to do because he didn't know if he would be sent back to where he came from, even though he's an American working in the United States, born in the United States, but detained at the Houston airport. So the scientist finally decides, Sid finally decides, okay, I'll give him the password. And he just didn't know what to do because it's such a violation of security rules for, you know, NASA's involved in all kinds of space activity involving military purposes, and you're supposed to protect that sensitive classified information with your life, basically. But they didn't care at immigration. So he coughs up the password, and then they disappear. They come back with his phone eventually and say, you're free to go. He has no idea. They've been unwilling to disclose at immigration what information they took off the phone, what they did with it, or the rest. They've just given a hard pushback to the media. When he got back to California, he went immediately to his work facility, and they gave him a new phone. They're now in possession of the phone, trying to figure out what happened with it. And this is one of those things that is so difficult because the job of people at immigration is to keep bad guys out of the country, to keep people from coming in who might mean us harm. And it's an extremely difficult job. At the same time, you have very few rights, if any. In fact, I think we should put up an article, what rights you don't have and what rights you do have if you are detained at immigration. So, Joel, if you don't mind, we should do that later. And, you know, I am a national security hawk. I am very, very intense about thinking that we need to take the steps necessary to keep our country and our fellow citizens safe. There are times where there's a complete lack of logic and common sense maybe in the execution of that, and ham-handed and how it's handled after the fact, just stonewalling the media inquiries is dumb on the part of immigration. Dumb. As for you, if you are very sensitive about the information you have on your phone, you're a very private person, and again, not somebody up to no good, because what's so ironic and funny about this is terrorists are going to use burner phones anyway. You know what a burner phone is? It's like a throwaway phone. And there's not going to be anything of note or use on it when they would enter the United States, unless they're just a really dumb terrorist. I guess there are those. Anyway, but for you, if you are an extremely private individual, when you leave the country, you should travel with a burner phone. That's very cheap. Usually an Android smartphone, you can get $40 or $50. You use it just for your trip. You put your SIM card in it. And when you come back, if immigration wants it, let them have it. There are all kinds of steps that the privacy freaks are talking about right now, about steps you can do to encrypt everything on your phone and lock it down and say, you have added immigration. You're not going to figure anything out. And if you're into that, well, you can do all those things. That's not my thing. I got nothing to hide. I have a dull life. But in a case where you were responsible for corporate or national security secrets, you need to be aware that maybe when you travel outside the United States, unless you must for work purposes, you do not travel with your work phone. Because you don't know, and it can be so random when you're pulled out of line, pulled aside, taken to a holding cell, then interrogated as if you are a threat to this great nation of ours. I want to say again, immigration handled this situation terribly. Dumb. But, and I'm not talking about pulling somebody aside and checking their phone. It's like after the fact, when it became a news story, going into the crouch position, hiding behind a rock is stupid. It creates more distrust among fellow Americans. The people that work at immigration, they are our first line of defense and have a very difficult job in protecting our nation. And they are to be commended. But you need to know, as a citizen, that your normal rights to due process do not exist when you're reentering the U.S. Kate is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Clark. How are you?
Great, thank you. You want to talk about protecting your finances from bad guys.
You got it. Hey, I'm pretty conservative. Do belt suspenders and maybe a second suspender.
Okay.
And I'm wondering how best I can go online to look at my 401k account or my brokerage account. And I thought about looking at the Chromebook, but my concern is that I'm tracked by having my dedicated Gmail account followed. What do you think? Am I being paranoid?
No, not at all. And I'm glad you're asking about this, because this is something that we addressed on the show twice recently, because a techie brought this to the table and explained something I had not really thought about. And he was so right that if you follow my guidance and you get a separate computer, a Chromebook, to pay your bills, to access your brokerage account, bank account, anything like that, that if you tie it in with your regular Gmail account, then you have not provided the level of security for your financial information that is the intention of doing so with a Chromebook. And what he suggested is such a brilliant idea and so simple. Aren't the best brilliant ideas simple?
Yes.
Is that you set up a separate Gmail account that is just for your bill pay computer or financial computer.
So if I do that, I still have that Gmail account dedicated to the financial transactions that a person or a bad guy could follow.
Yeah, but it doesn't tie into the rest of your life.
So compared to a regular laptop, is the Gmail account more easily traceable than a regular laptop?
No. I mean, see, the beauty of a Chromebook, Chromebooks have not had problems with viruses of any kind like Windows PCs or MacBooks. So the idea of the Chromebook is because basically it's a web surfing machine. You are much less vulnerable with it than you are with a traditional computer. That's why Microsoft is bringing to market a Microsoft-type version of a Windows computer that has the safety and security that you have with a Chromebook. Because this is such an important area to stay safe.
Right. So the cloud offers some protection beyond what a regular laptop would.
Completely.
Okay.
Because there's no...
That makes me feel better.
Your information is all web-based, so there's nothing for someone to come and put a virus on your computer and access everything on the computer, which is why Chromebooks are so much safer. That's why school systems have adopted them so heavily. Not just because they're cheaper to buy, but they're so much cheaper to administer because they don't have to worry about all the viruses and all the things that can plague a traditional computer, either a Windows or a Mac.
Okay.
And do you have a Chromebook you're going to use, or do you have to buy one?
I do have one.
Okay. For others, listen to this. What did you pay for your Chromebook?
$150.
Okay, so that's a great price. On Groupon, you know that website Groupon everybody's forgotten about?
Yeah.
They've got a bunch of Chromebooks on sale, and they start at $119. One with a 15.6-inch screen is $129. And they've got a whole slew of them at different price points. And that's a deal.
That is a deal.
Because you're buying basically a web appliance that keeps you more secure from hackers and criminals and paying so little for it that you might as well have a separate computer. And if you haven't heard me say this, if you are a business owner and you don't use a separate computer for your financial stuff, payroll, anything like that, you are really asking for it because you're failing under the Uniform Commercial Code to show that you're taking due care to protect the financial security of your business, and you can end up being held liable for all losses suffered financially through your bank account, payroll, or anything like that. Michael is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Clark.
Michael, you are a Nissan Leaf owner.
Yes, sir, and proud of it, too.
I've had my Leaf now 6 years.
Well, that answers part of my question because I've had mine going on 3 years, and I called 3 years ago and got some advice from you on whether or not to purchase or lease. And I took your advice, and I leased, and the lease is coming up in a few months. And one thing I did not research and discuss with you is I wanted to find out about the battery, because the battery replacement, how long does the battery last and how much it costs to place? And what about my options after the lease is up?
Okay, so let's deal with all that in the reverse order. Turn your vehicle in when the lease is up, even if you love it. Because the residual in your lease is, if it's like most of the Nissan leases I've heard about, would require you to pay somewhere in the mid-teens to buy your Leaf at the end of the lease. Is that about the right number for yours?
About, yeah.
Okay, because right now you can buy a used Leaf of an age probably similar to your three-year-old when you're turning in for somewhere $6,000, $7,000, or $8,000, because the used Leaf market is flooded. So if you love your Leaf, you're probably going to find it's better to dump yours and buy another three-year-old one at less than half the cost you'd pay under residual. Now, I'm having terrible battery problems with my Leaf. The range of it has reduced dramatically, and it's a problem because I've really got to think about with a trip if I can take it in the Leaf. And mine was a very, very early production model. It was not a pre-production, but it was one of the first ones pretty much commercially available in the U.S. And I've heard that the batteries on the early ones like mine are very unreliable and have deteriorated quite rapidly, but other people with newer Leafs have not reported that problem at all. But if you do follow my suggestion, turn in the Leaf you have. When you go to buy another one, you know there's that dial to the right-hand side of where you charge a Leaf that will show you how much the Leaf battery has deteriorated. And if it's still at 100% strength, you will be fine buying that as a used Leaf. If it's had a significant loss in the capacity of the battery, if it's really deteriorated, don't buy that one. It's time for Ask Clark. That's where producer Joel gives a question to me that you have posted at Clark.com. Joel, who do you have one from?
Clark got a question from Julia. She says, I pay half my mortgage payment twice a month, the payment taken directly from my checking account. My mortgage company takes the payment on the 15th of the month. They hold it, and they don't apply it until the 1st of the month. It seems to me that they're getting the benefit from having my payments for that 15 to 16 days interest-free. If they applied the payment, I would owe less interest because my principal would be less. Is it legal for them to hold on to the money without applying it?
Okay, so this is where mortgages differ from most other loans. Generally, with your credit card, with an auto loan, the interest is figured daily as a simple interest. Mortgages are calculated on an amortization schedule where the interest is calculated on a monthly basis. And so mortgage lenders, because that's how they do it in the United States, and as best I know, we're the only developed country to do it this way. There is no benefit to paying your mortgage in part or in whole early, because the lender isn't going to give you credit for it till the due date anyway. So the alternative I've recommended is, if your goal is to extinguish your mortgage quicker, just pay it monthly, but pay a little bit extra every month as an additional towards principal. That can shave potentially years off the length of your mortgage, and the lender can't stop you from doing that.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports this podcast. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust, someone who's got your best interests in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. Don't waste time searching through stacks of paperwork. With Rocket Mortgage, you can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in just minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure that you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. So whether you're looking to buy a home or refinance your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. Skip the bank. Skip the waiting. Go completely online at quickenloans.com/save. That's quickenloans.com/save. Let Rocket Mortgage help you get the exact mortgage solution that you need. Go to quickenloans.com/save. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
I'm glad you're here with us today on the Clark Howard Show. You know why I'm glad? Because I hope that I can empower you with knowledge that helps you fatten your wallet, that helps you take control of your financial present and future, that you'll keep more of what you make. On the web, Clark.com. When you're looking for deals, ClarkDeals.com, there to serve you 24 hours a day. Coming up a half hour from now, there's a big change in how you buy organic foods, groceries in general. I want to tell you how you can get the most savings because of the shakeup going on now in the grocery market. And I want to talk about Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck not giving you the best gift right now. Prices have gone up again for the Magic Kingdom and the other Disney parks. The big ones in Central Florida near Orlando getting really pricey, but also variable pricing is completely at the core of how Disney is charging you for admission. Now, let me give you one bit of good news. Disney ran up rates last year, and the result of that is attendance at the Disney parks declined last year. So the crowd's a little thinner, not a huge amount of thinness, but a little thinner because of price resistance. You know, there's only so much you can raise prices. But I would guess that Disney feels like they have no choice because, you know, they own ESPN, and ESPN is in steep decline and has always been such a huge profit engine for the company. And so they're raising rates at Disney once more. The prices are based on peak, off-peak, and regular price days. So there are bargain days, there are premium days, and there are those in the middle. So they call the bargain days value days. And the value days are now $99. Isn't that really funny to call that a value? Oh, boy. $99. Well, you can have a lot of fun there standing in line. So we have a guide that we put up at Clark.com about how the whole ticket thing works. The best deals of all for Walt Disney World are for Florida residents. Florida residents can buy an annual pass, and it's the equivalent cost of 5 days at the park, at any of the parks, and then every day beyond five is essentially free. It's $559 outlay of cash. And the way they do it for the Florida residents is that there are certain days that are the same peak days when attendance would be at its max, which you don't want to be there anyway when people are stacked on top of people on top of people, that you're not allowed to go. But other than that, the Florida resident pass is a real deal. And the parking, okay, now this is the funniest thing. What do you think it costs now to park at what they call preferred parking, which are the close-in parking spaces? $40 a day. $40 a day. So my kids, well, two of them are old enough, they don't ask about going to Disney. And for some reason, my 11-year-old never asks about going. Maybe it's because he doesn't want me to keel over at the ticket window at the cost. It is a fun and truly magical experience to go, but not so much for your wallet. On the good side, for your stay in Central Florida, there's such a gigantic number of hotel rooms, condos, apartments for rent, Airbnbs, that the cost of accommodations, especially for a big family group, the cost per person per night is very, very reasonable. But those tickets, whew. And the thing with variable pricing, so much a part of how things are done. If you look at what Major League Baseball has done, with Major League Baseball, the pricing is so variable based on the opponent, the day of the week, and the time of the season, that if you go to a game typically early in the season, but after the first week of home games of a season, before Memorial Day, the variable pricing for off-peak is extremely good. On the other hand, when a marquee opponent comes into town, and especially if that game is on a Friday night, Saturday, or Sunday, it in turn is peak pricing. And I support that completely, because a seat at an arena is not worth the same every event. And the demand being what it is, it creates the opportunity when it's an opponent people aren't that interested in, or it's, let's say, midweek, there's an opportunity to get into a park at rates that, for a major league event, any family should be able to afford, as long as you don't eat at the facility. Chris is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Clark. How are you today?
Great, thank you. Have you ever been to Walt Disney World?
No, never have, and don't think I want to go.
Oh, really? Not your kind of thing? How about Universal or anything like that?
Yeah, I guess I'm an older guy, and those kind of things just don't interest me a whole lot.
Okay. Well, what does interest you? How can I serve you today?
Well, I'll tell you what, for years I've been thinking about LASIK surgery, for eye surgery, and I keep upgrading my glasses every year, year and a half, and it's got to the point now where I got blurry vision. So I was checking out LASIK, and I've seen so many price ranges, some high dollar, and then there's some change that's coming in with low dollars, and I just want to know what way to go.
So this is a tough one because this is where the wallet meets medicine and science. So there are high volume chains. There used to be a lot more through the shakeout phase with LASIK, but there are the volume chains that charge like $250, $300, $350
an eye. Yep.
And then there are the boutique places that do LASIK that charge several thousand dollars an eye.
Exactly.
And this one is one of those things that does not have a right answer. You know, when you go to the high volume chains, you have the benefit that this person, the ophthalmologist doing the procedure, does a ton of them. And there's an advantage with medical procedures when someone has a great deal of experience. But also, you are in basically a factory, an assembly line. And if you have issues or problems later, the difficulty you might have with one of the high-volume discounters is that any follow-through is extra, any what they call the euphemism enhancements. Do you know what enhancements means in laser LASIK surgery?
Yes, I do.
Okay. A lot of people may not be aware that after you have an eye done, you may need follow-up surgery, that it may not have gone exactly as they planned. And with the high-volume discounters, you will usually pay every time they do any kind of follow-up. With the boutique practices, where you pay a much higher price up front, it tends to be a more personalized experience, and more time will typically be spent with you, pre-qualifying you as a candidate, and then doing the procedure. And as a general rule, it's not ever going to be 100%, but as a general rule, all follow-up is included in the initial price you pay.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I can't say that, oh, yeah, just go to the place that's $300 an eye, whatever.
Yeah.
So it does matter on reputation, what people have to say about it. Now, there's a website that we have been directing people to check out doctors and get referral for doctors and reviews of doctors. And I would suggest that you go to ZocDoc, ZocDoc, and see what kind of ratings are listed for ophthalmologists in your area and practices that do LASIK surgery.
Okay, I'm familiar with your website, and I will check that out.
Okay, and you know, your eyes are a very precious thing. I have a sister-in-law who, what I've found with LASIK is that some of you had a bad result, just hates it, and most people have a great result. She had a bad result, and it's been a real issue for her with her eyes. And then another sister-in-law had it and thinks it's the greatest thing ever. My wife had it and thinks it's the greatest thing ever.
Okay. I haven't ran into too many negative. I got a lot of friends that got it done, and they just swear by it.
Right. And my wife has been begging me to have LASIK for about 15 years. Because I'm a four eyes like you. I wear glasses.
Yeah, I know what you mean. So, well, I will check out the information on your website. And I do want to say, before you let me go here, that we swear by your program and the advice you give. And my family's coming to me with questions asking what Clark would say. So
wow.
We appreciate what you do.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad I've been able to be of service. Frank is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Clark. How are you today?
Great. Thank you. You are going to be a new home buyer sometime in this year.
Yes, sir. It's going to be our fourth home. We just moved back home to Arizona. And my question is, the home won't be done for at least a year or so. And if we were to purchase a car, maybe a $15,000 loan or less, would that negatively affect our credit score by the time the home closes?
Likely not. You know, what I have generally said is cordon off the 6 months before you're going to close on a mortgage from any applications for credit. So if you are going to buy a car now and take out a loan for it, and you're looking at more than 12 months away from buying the home, I would not worry about the impact on your credit score at all. There is a second issue, though, and that is that mortgage lenders look very closely at ratios, you know, debt to income. And if having that car loan throws your debt ratios out of kilter based on your income, then that could negatively impact you going through underwriting. As far as your score, the odd thing is that taking out that car loan now and making those payments every month on time might actually have the effect of boosting your credit score.
Interesting. We it's funny you said that about debt to income. I spoke to my mortgage person, and with the house we're looking at, income and all that stuff put together, as long as I keep it at a reasonable payment, he says we shouldn't have an issue.
As long as you've done that step in advance, don't fret at all about taking out a car loan this far ahead of buying a home. But I want you to remember what Frank and I are talking about. When you're buying a home, do not, in the months leading up to buying that home, take out any new credit cards. Even if you're replacing an old one, don't do it. Don't take out any car loans. No borrowing whatsoever to mess up that process of buying that home and qualifying for that mortgage. Lucas is with us on the Clark Howard Show. Lucas, you are self-employed, and you got a question for me about the most advantageous option for you with health care. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
So what are you thinking of?
Okay, so I was on a survey, and I was looking at how to combine an HRA with an HSA, and I am a single self-employed individual, and I do not have any employees.
Okay, forget the HRA, although HRAs are legal again under certain circumstances as of last month. The HSA for you as a self-employed individual has enormous advantages. You get a tax break up front when you put money in a health savings account. All the earnings you get on the HSA are tax-free. And then you use the money tax-free for medical expenses that you have. The big advantage for you, though, Lucas, when you're self-employed, is that if you don't actually use the HSA for current unreimbursed medical expenses that are coupled with your high deductible health plan, that you keep rolling the money forward in the HSA and let it continue to grow tax-free to spend much later in your life as tax-free money. I direct you, do this search on Google, put Vanguard HSA, and first of all, it's the best place to do an HSA through the Vanguard program, and read their explanation about why the HSA is perfect for you.
Okay, you want to keep your favorite podcasts like this one free to download, right? Well, then all you have to do is complete a short anonymous survey, which takes less than 5 minutes. Just go to podcastone.com/mysurvey to answer the questions. You can also get there by clicking the banner at podcastone.com. If you've done this in the past, we'd like to thank you, but we do need you to do it again, because we want to make sure we're giving you what you want. That's podcastone.com/mysurvey, or click the banner at podcastone.com.
Stay tuned for 60 seconds of AP News headlines right after this podcast.
It's great to have you here on the Clark Howard Show, where it's about you learning ways to save more and spend less, and don't let anyone ever rip you off. You can follow me at facebook.com/ClarkHoward. Clark.com is our website. When you have a question for me, Clark.com/ask. So I told you back in December why not to give people gift cards for restaurants, because the restaurant industry is really hurting. The reason? Groceries have never been cheaper in the United States. We are in a cycle with commodities that the ultimate cost you pay for food is way, way, way down. The percent of the average person's dollar that goes to food and groceries is the smallest ever since measurements like that started. The price gap between what you pay for a meal at a restaurant, where there are a whole different factors involved than the cost of food. The cost of labor, which is going up for the restaurateurs, has been a big cause of the gap between this spread between the cost of eating out and eating at home. Restaurateurs are reporting declines in traffic all across America. And then within the grocery business, there's a big shift going on. For the first time since such stats were kept, more groceries are being bought that are organic at non-organic grocers than at organic grocers. So people are buying their organics everywhere. They're buying them at Costco. They're buying them at Aldi, at Trader Joe's, at traditional supermarket chains like Kroger and all Kroger sub-brand names, because they're the second largest in the business. Walmart, which is the nation's largest supermarket chain, stocking an ever wider variety of organics and fresh produce. And the market has shifted so much that Whole Foods is now having to shrink. Whole Foods is trying to figure out what the new business model is. Other than closing stores they already have, what are they going to do to deal with the fact that they are exposed now with so much more competition, and their store count now nationwide is 400 and something stores, I think. And this is a chain that was expected to go to thousands of stores everywhere, but they've stalled out because now they don't have value proposition. They have beautiful stores, but you can go anywhere to get what they do. Maybe not the theatrical aspect of it, but you can get much lower prices at mainstream traditional players and certainly at the discounters. And Aldi has been an enormous threat to Whole Foods and to traditional supermarkets. But Aldi, which now, so think about that, Whole Foods has roughly 400 stores or so. Aldi is up to 1,600 in the United States and is opening more stores in the next few years than the entire Whole Food chain is. They're opening 650 additional stores in just the next few years. And the ones they have, they're spending nearly $2 billion creating within the footprint they already are more selling space, about 20% more space by reducing the back room space to create more selling space for organics and produce, which is what the market is asking for, particularly millennials who have a much higher emphasis on buying organics and fresh fruits and vegetables. So where you do your grocery shopping is going through a big shift. And what you pay is steadily getting better. And people who follow the grocery business very closely are all about the fact that Lidl is coming into the United States. And they're opening first in Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, with a goal of expanding along the eastern seaboard. No plans yet to go into the western part of the country. But anybody who's lived or traveled extensively in Europe is already familiar with Lidl, spelled L-I-D-L. I've shopped for years at Lidl overseas, and they are a superior operator. They seem somewhat like Aldi, with smaller format stores, but they are much more heavily brand name oriented, a lot of fresh foods, and they sell at such a massive discount to traditional supermarkets that Lidl is much more a direct competitor to traditional supermarkets than Aldi. Aldi, I love Aldi. I shop at Aldi. It's an acquired taste. But what I want you to know is that there has never been a time that your food dollar has gone further than it does right now. And you can choose by where you shop to make it stretch even more. And I believe the strategy for Whole Foods to survive is going to be based on their experimental chain, 365. 365 is built from the ground up, is more like a Trader Joe's or an Aldi with much lower labor costs and a more beautiful environment, but much more no frills, and thus able to give much lower price points, because there is no business model that allows an ultra-expensive grocer like Whole Foods to thrive when there's now so much direct competition. Sabrina's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi, how are you, Clark?
Great, thank you. You are trying to help a relative. What's going on?
Well, our stepson got over his head in debt.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We knew nothing about it. He didn't come to us until it was deep. And he even tapped his 401k to help pay off the credit cards.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. So what we did was we were going to come up with a plan, but I got a sticking point. What we would like to do is, if it's not too much, I got to look at his papers and see how much the debt is. But to pay off his debt, because his credit cards are 24%, we will obviously make him pay it back, but it may be 3%.
Okay, now wait.
Go ahead.
I got to stop you right there because I hear your heart talking. So, Sabrina, somebody who has run up a lot of debt and is a family member and you do a workout for them, that's what it's called, you know, a workout where you pay off the high interest rate debt,
right,
and you become the lender for the lower interest rate debts. You said something right there that I got to throw the flag on. You said, and of course we'll make him pay it back. The odds are that he may intend to pay you back, but they're not high that it'll actually happen. So when you, if you were to do something like this, you have to think of it in terms of you will call it a loan to him. You'll even have loan terms. But psychologically, in your own mind, you have to be prepared that this may ultimately be a gift, not a loan.
Of course. And knowing him the way I do, he will sell an organ to pay that money back because it is killing him. That's why he never came to us. He was so guilt-ridden over having run up the debt that he didn't want to come to us.
And what kind of, so, was it lifestyle things, or did he have a medical problem, or what caused the debt, as best you can tell?
It started with a car that died, and he had to go out and buy a car. And then from there, we also think that he got himself into some credit card debt, that he started then maybe buying scratch-offs.
Oh, no.
Thinking that, you know, the answer is in the lottery. And then I think it snowballed. But I don't know because he hasn't told us the whole story yet. But he used to send me pictures of his cell phone showing his credit rating of over 800. So he's been a good spender in the past. I think he just got in over his head on this.
Okay, so let me tell you what I think needs to happen next, and it's not you giving him a loan.
Okay.
What he needs to do is, if he's got the best of intentions and things got out of control on him, he needs to sit down with a budget counselor. And there's a group called the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Have you ever heard me mention them?
I have.
He may have to hear it several times before he'll be willing to make an appointment and go in. But they'll take him to the root cause of, because everybody's always got a story about how they ended up where they did with debt.
Right.
But it's a plan and a map, basically, that gets you onto a new path. And you just lending him the money, I don't think changes whatever it was that got him to where he is. And that's why I think he needs the tough love of a budget counselor to help him see a path to a better way of handling his money. Because even if you later choose to lend him the money, the things that brought him to where he is, those have to change first.
Oh, I completely agree.
So what I would say is, have you broached the subject with him of lending him money?
No, in fact, we were going to meet with him either tonight or sometime this week.
Oh, great. Because I don't want that out there yet as a carrot or a possibility.
Right.
I would go in with the idea that you want him to go sit down with somebody at the closest NFCC affiliate. And you go in with the information for him. If you go to nfcc.org, you'll be able to find the closest affiliate. And generally, if they sit down and do counseling with him at most affiliates, that's free or it's so cheap, it's like insignificant.
Great.
Now, they can go an additional step. If he's really boxed himself into a corner, they can actually negotiate a payment plan with the various companies he owes money to, and they may even be able to get the interest rate marked down to zero, which would be better than your
3%. Sure.
And then you're not in this thing where you have lent money, and then the awkward thing happens. Well, he didn't pay this month. He didn't pay next month. I mean, we got to get to the heart, the root of how he got there and how he's going to get out. So I strongly recommend this as a path instead of you writing a check. And maybe at some point writing a check will become part of it, but he needs to really show some discipline through a process that essentially straitjackets his spending.
Okay.
And Sabrina, if you get into this with him and there's a lot of resistance, I would like you to encourage him to call me and let me have a conversation with your stepson.
Okay.
Because you don't need to be the bad guy if it gets contentious. Let me play that
right.
role. You know, because you want to preserve family, and I'm not blood to him. So let him be mad at me. Larry's with us on the Clark Howard Show. Hello, Larry. How are you doing?
Hi, Clark. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You got a credit freeze question for me.
I do. I took your advice to help protect me from identity theft and froze my credit. And I'm in the process of thinking about applying for another credit card. And before I started to thaw my credit, I wondered if I just need to thaw just for one credit agency, or do I need to thaw all three?
This is a frustration of mine because you should only have to thaw one. And generally, when a financial institution is pulling a credit report to decide whether to grant you a credit card or not, they are pulling from a single bureau because they have to pay for every time they tap into one. Mm-hmm. And I have repeatedly, when I've had to thaw my credit for an application for a new credit card or because I'm getting a new cell phone service or whatever, I have never, ever been able to get someone at customer service to tell me what bureau they draw from and which one that I need to thaw. And so I've had to thaw all three when I've done opened an account for somewhere where they want to pull your credit or done an application for credit. And that's silly.
Well, before I spent the money to do it, I just wanted to run it past you first. And
I think it's worth you, though, Larry, giving a call to the credit card company. Is it one of the big issuers?
Yes.
Do you happen to have a card with one of them right now?
I do not.
Because many times you have access to some equivalent of your credit score now for credit cards that you have, and they'll tell you, you know, this is based on your Equifax report or Experian or TransUnion. They'll tell you which one, and then you know who that bank, or have a pretty good idea who that bank is going to draw a report from for a credit app. But without that kind of source information, if no one can tell you when you call in, you know, because sometimes they'll have a number you can call in to apply for a card over the phone that will be separate than their regular customer no service call-in number. And you might have a better chance with one of those people who might well know which bureau they pull from.
Okay, I'll give that some thought.
And then you'd be able to thaw just that one. How much is it to thaw a report in your state?
I have not checked.
All right, that was kind of a trick question. Because in, I think, the majority of states, even if there's a fee to freeze your credit, typically there's no fee to thaw it temporarily.
Okay.
I live in a state where every time you thaw a report, you have to pay $3 per bureau. So then I'm looking at $9 instead of $3 when I can't get that answer.
Right.
But compared to the hassle of dealing with identity theft, I'm happy to pay that $9.
Absolutely. I rest easier at night knowing that I'm better protected from identity theft with having my credit frozen.
Good choice to do that. And if you want to know how to do it yourself, if you go to Clark.com, go read our credit freeze guide, in just minutes, you can lock down your credit from a criminal who might decide to pretend they're you and open credit accounts as if they are you.
Thanks for listening to the Clark Howard Podcast. Download new episodes every Monday through Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Hey, it's Jordan Harbinger. For the last 10 years, I've successfully helped people build their self-confidence with my Art of Charm podcast. And now, along with Art of Charm, I'm hosting a new show. It's Podcast One's latest program, The Forbes List. On the show, we talk to the Forbes editors that curate their famous and respected lists, like self-made richest people, billionaires, and highest-paid athletes. We'll get behind-the-scenes insight and information that doesn't make the print cut. It launches this week, on February 16th, so please subscribe on iTunes to the Forbes List, and don't forget to rate us, review, and share.
What we're learning about the Manchester bomber. I'm Rita Foley with an AP News Minute. The father of the alleged Manchester suicide bomber says his son didn't do it. We don't believe in killing innocents, he told the AP. But the father reportedly was a member of an Al-Qaeda-backed group in Libya years ago. That, according to a former Libyan security official. Meanwhile, police have carried out raids on a block of apartments in Manchester. Witnesses say they heard explosions. Alan Kinsey was a neighbor of the alleged bomber.
The actual family that had been there, I'd never really come across them in bad ways. It was always, even when I said hello, he never seemed to speak back to you. He was just like, kept themselves to themselves, and that was about it.
The British putting more military troops on the streets now, as police say it's clear this is a network they're investigating. President Trump has arrived in Brussels for NATO meetings after a visit this morning with the Pope at the Vatican. I'm Rita Foley.